Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 165, SecularSynagogue.com. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And before we get into today's interview, we want to follow up on our announcement last week that we have reached our 1 millionth download. In celebration of our millionth download, we are having an online party. What does that mean exactly? It's an experiment. It's a Judaism Unbound experiment that we're really excited about. We're not totally sure how to do an online party properly, so we're just going to do it. Basically, everybody should bring their own food, their own party hats, their own questions and comments, and we're going to begin with a conversation with three of our guests. Our very first ever guest, B'nai Lappi. And then we're going to be talking to Stanford University professor Ari Kelman, who recently put out a study of digital Jewish learning. So we're excited to talk about that and get into that a little bit more. And also we have Miriam Cherlenchamp, who is one of our fellow experimenters in this world of digital Judaism, specifically with all kinds of digital videos that she's created that have gotten also over a million views. So those are the guests that we're having for a short conversation at the beginning to kick things off. But then we're going to open the floor to our over 30 and growing number of previous guests who are definitely confirmed to be there. And also folks like you who want to have some talk and conversation and ask questions and make comments. And what we're trying to do is sort of take Judaism Unbound to the next level, or begin to take Judaism Unbound to the next level, by making the flow of conversation go in both directions. So for the last 3 years, you've been used to hearing us and probably haven't had all that much opportunity to talk to us unless we've done an event locally in your community, which we'd love to do more of. So this is an experiment. It's a start. It's also a party, and we just want to have a great time with you. So when is this party going to be, you ask? That's a great question. It's going to be on Tuesday, April 23rd at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. That's 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Time and 7 o'clock p.m. where I am here in the Midwest. We're calling the party for an hour and a half, but if you can only come at some point for a few minutes, that's great. If you can stay the whole time, that's great. And if you can only stay part of the time, the beginning, the end, the middle, we don't care. We're just excited to have everybody there. And how do you join? You use a program that we actually use to record the podcast called Zoom. You don't really have to do too much if you're not familiar with it. You just press a URL and it'll sort of set itself up for you. How do you get that URL? Go to www.judaismunbound.com/party. That's www.judaismunbound.com/party, and it'll give you all the information that you need. And now let's get into our interview. Our guest today is Denise Handlarski. She is the founder of SecularSynagogue.com. We're going to do a deep dive into what that's all about. But one thing that I do want to tell you here at the beginning is that if you're interested in the idea of SecularSynagogue.com and you want to join, just head over to SecularSynagogue.com and you can find out about becoming a member. The way SecularSynagogue.com works is that they accept members in groups. So you can't join every day of the year. You can only join every few months when they do a new round of membership joining. They happen to be in the process of such a round right now. So if you're interested in what you're hearing, you can join Secular Synagogue right now. And as further enticement, they are going to be doing a digital Seder on April 14th at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. It's for members only. So if you're interested, check it out. Denise Handlarski, in addition to being the founder of SecularSynagogue.com, is also the rabbi of a more traditional congregation, although it's in the secular humanistic movement, so it's also less traditional. But she also serves as the rabbi of Orenu Congregation in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Denise Handlarski has rabbinical ordination from the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism, and also she holds a PhD in English literature. She also serves as a Jewish doula, helping folks all over the world bring Jewish spirituality into pregnancy and birth. She's also a professor, a mom, a fan of good wine and bad television, as she says in her bio. We're really thrilled to have her here on the podcast to learn a little bit about her organization and perhaps through her organization about a new way of thinking about synagogues and what the digital space has to offer for the future of Judaism. So, Denise Handlarski, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
It's so great to be with you.
I wanted to start by asking you, you know, it's a lot of times, usually Lex asks this question, where he's interested in the name of an organization, but it's kind of hard not to start there when the name of your organization is secularsynagogue.com, where I think each word in that name has a bunch of questions and might be a full episode of its own. I could imagine that we were talking to the founder of synagogue.com, and that would be an interesting conversation in its own right, but secularsynagogue.com takes it to a new level. So I'd like to start by just asking you to tell us a little bit about what that is, when it came about, and what you're trying to achieve there and what's happening.
A lot of Jews are some version of secular or humanist or culturally Jewish or, you know, spiritual but not religious. And there is, I think, a deep desire to connect to the Jewish world. And in a lot of the organized Jewish world, the way you connect is through synagogues. If you're someone like me, who is a secular Jew and a very involved Jew, I practice Judaism daily, I felt always excluded from a synagogue space because the main thing that goes on there is a prayer service. So the vision for secularsynagogue.com is to merge what goes on in secular or humanistic Jewish communities. I serve one of those in real life communities in Toronto, Canada, where I live, and to do it digitally, to do it online, partly because there are Jews everywhere who aren't finding spaces that meet their needs, whether they're in smaller communities, whether they're in places where Jewish life tends to run a little more conservative, or just places where they haven't found their own particular community that's a fit for them. I thought, why not bring the great things about communal life, learning, practice, ritual, community, all of that good stuff into the digital sphere to connect those Jews who aren't being served?
So you said something in your answer that I want to reflect on and talk about, and then I want to connect that to the concepts of synagogue and secularsynagogue.com. You said, I'm a secular Jew, and you said, I practice Judaism daily. And I think that that's a phrase that a lot of us who are secular Jews don't tend to use, I practice Judaism daily, that somehow we think of the practice of Judaism as a religious act of some kind. I don't want to think about it that way. I really don't think about it that way when I'm really thinking about it, but it's not a phrase that I would probably use. So I'm interested in when you say I practice Judaism daily, can you give us a little bit of a flavor of what that practice is? What Jewish things that you do that you think of as a practice? And then I'm interested in how you're building communal organization around those things, both in person at the secular synagogue dot real life that you are the rabbi of, and also on secularsynagogue.com, and what are the commonalities and what are the differences between the in-person version and the online version?
What I would say is, firstly, to answer the part about why call it Jewish practice, I actually think there's an interesting dynamic, and it informs a lot of my work, and I think it informs the lives of the people I'm in community with, where what has been termed Jewish practice has actually very often been defined through a religious lens or a religious experience. And lots of us have been told, well, if we're not keeping kosher, or if we're not doing daily prayer, then we're not practicing Judaism the right way. And that drives me bananas, frankly, because I think there are lots and lots of ways to practice Judaism. And often the secular cultural Jews have internalized that narrative. So we ourselves don't think we're practicing Judaism when we may be. So in my daily life, some of the things I do are I read Jewish media. I talk about topics of interest to Jewish communities. This morning, I was part of a meeting on combating anti-Semitism and white supremacist movements more broadly. I see that as Jewish practice. I read Jewish children's books to my kids. We sing Jewish songs. I personally have a weekly Shabbat practice. Not everybody does, but I see Judaism as being really informing a lot of my daily life, and it doesn't have to be prayer for it to be serious, meaningful Judaism. So to segue into answering the part of the question about what I do in community with folks, So the community I serve in Toronto is called the Oreno Congregation for Humanistic Judaism. It is an affiliate of the Humanistic Jewish Movement. I was ordained by the Humanistic Jewish Movement as a rabbi. So we get together for services. They don't look like traditional prayer services, but we have creative liturgy where it's earth-centered and human-centered, beautiful, moving, meaningful poetry, music, readings, meditations. And so we do that together around Shabbat or around holidays. And we have all kinds of other programming going on, speakers, social events, cultural programming like plays. All of that I see as Jewish practice that we can do together. And then in the digital space, what I see as a real opportunity is to get together more often. My community in Toronto, which I sometimes call in real life, although it's all real life, whether it's digital or in person.
Spoiler, more on that later, yeah.
For sure. So it's all real. But when we get together in person, just the logistics of the busyness of life and space and all that kind of stuff, we tend to have a program about every 2 weeks. And I'm interacting with congregants one-on-one sometimes, but truthfully, there will be moments where weeks go by before I will interact with a congregant, and sometimes longer. It depends on their interest in reaching out and in hanging out with me and all that kind of stuff. So what I notice about secularsynagogue.com is that we're not getting together in person, but we're hanging out every day. There's conversation going every single day. And so the intimacy that you get in an in-person interaction might be different than the intimacy you get in digital interactions, but they're both special and meaningful in their own way.
So can you describe a little bit about how secularsynagogue.com works? Like, I join it and what happens to me?
When you join, a few things happen. You get access to a part of the secularsynagogue.com website, which is for members. And on there, there's stuff like run a DIY Shabbat. And in that file, there's information about some secular blessings that a lot of people have never had the opportunity to learn. There's also traditional material in there for people who want to learn about it. There are suggestions for readings and practices and things you can do. There's parenting resources on there. There's fun stuff like have a scavenger hunt at where you live about the Jewish history of the place. So a bunch of different resources. But the main function of the group is actually a closed Facebook group. I'm not sure it will always be Facebook, but for now, that seems to be the platform that works best for folks in terms of where we are anyway and where we're used to having some of these conversations. Sometimes people have said to me, well, why would I pay for access to a Facebook group when there are so many Facebook groups to access for free? So just to answer that question, I would say the platform could shift. What you're paying for is access to a community, and unlike Facebook groups that I'm part of that are, you know, not membership based where, you know, everybody's calling themselves part of a community, people drop in and out. There may be a few louder voices, a few quieter voices. This does feel to me more like a community. We know each other. We share more personal stuff than perhaps goes on in other kinds of Facebook groups, which have a more public face. We offer each other real support. Sometimes people put out there, you know, I'm struggling with mental health, or this is an issue that's going on in my marriage. We're offering each other real, meaningful communal support in addition to doing Jewish learning and Torah study and mitzvah Mondays and all different kinds of stuff together. So the platform is largely a Facebook group, but the group does feel different than any other Facebook group I'm part of.
I love the way that you framed that, where you said that all of this is real life, where what's happening digitally through secularsynagogue.com is real life, what's happening in a shared physical geographic proximity is also real life. This is a message that I've like adopted as like a quest, as like a thing that I like will literally shout sometimes. Sometimes it's in frustration in my own house when nobody can hear me. Other times it's like actually animatedly in conversation, because I think this is deeply harmful. I think it's not just semantics, because here's what's happening when we say the phrase real life and juxtapose it against virtual digital Judaism. We imply that of necessity, physical, geographically proximal interactions are better along the vast majority of axes than digital. And look, there are lots of ways that interacting in physical geographic proximity is better. I can hug more effectively when somebody is in a room with me than I can through video chat. I haven't yet figured out a way to do that. Interestingly, there are apps where you can put your thumb on the same part of the screen and it's like a simulated kiss thing. I know this because I was in a long distance relationship for a while and we had this app, but it's not as good. It's not the same thing. That said, when we say real life versus virtual, we forget that actually there's parts of digital Judaism where certain things are easier to do, where actually certain elements of us can be more present, and where certain fears of in-person are not as present. And so one piece I always talk about is when you're in an in-person conversation, if you're, let's picture a common one in synagogues, like after services, everybody's schmoozing, eating whatever snacks, and sort of talking to one another. You're talking about something Jewish and somebody says a term you don't know. You feel dumb. In that in-person conversation, you can't Google your friend. Like you can't press a button and learn whatever term that they used. And you have to actively speak up and say, oh, I don't know what that is. That probably makes you feel a little inadequate or dumb. People talk all the time about how in Jewish circumstances they feel not Jewish enough or they feel like they don't have enough knowledge. When you're interacting in a digital forum, the second you don't know what something means, you can look it up. And that's a benefit. That is something that is better about digital Judaism. And we have to be able to say there are some things that are better without that meaning to somebody that, oh, I'm attacking geographically proximal interactions. No, I'm not attacking them. I have them in my life all the time. So that's a long question. Give me more stuff on this real life presumption that you're putting forward, because I think that our listeners may not think of themselves, say, as interacting with us in real life, but I'd argue we are.
What I was thinking about with my personal life when I started secularsynagogue.com, which just launched this past September, I launched it to coincide with the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur period. So it's a relatively new project, a relatively new community. It's amazing to see the beautiful, meaningful, and intimate connections that have been formed in a pretty short time, where I would argue that takes longer sometimes in the in-person communities where people are getting together less often. So the fact that we're seeing each other every single day, I do think actually adds something that you don't necessarily get in many congregations. I know there will be some people who say, I go to my Orthodox synagogue every day, but I serve secular folks who usually don't go to their spaces every single day. And so I think that the immediacy where digital Judaism can reach you, the frequency, and in some ways, I think you're right, the user-friendly nature of it. To your example, not only in those side conversations at Kiddush or something when someone's like, oh, I don't know that term, or I don't know what holiday they're referring to or whatever, I'll Google it later, but in this conversation, I have to pretend I know something I don't. This seems a little, I don't mean it to seem big brothery, like I'm watching everything, but I can see all the conversations that go on in secularsynagogue.com. So I wouldn't let somebody feel that they didn't know something. Every time somebody says a term in Hebrew or, you know, mentions something, a Jewish idea, even if it's something that I assume many people know, like tzedakah, I'll always gloss it. I'll always explain what it is, just so that people don't feel like they have to do that work on their own.
And what's
that's
tzedakah?
Part of how tzedakah is the Jewish idea of charity or justice. I like to think of it as justice, but when people do work in the community, if they serve a food bank or a soup kitchen, we'll often call that tzedakah work. And so I never want people to feel left out of conversations. And as the leader in a digital space, I can better ensure that everybody feels like they have the opportunity to come along with whatever conversation is going on. And what I found with secularsynagogue.com is a bunch of people who joined it are also members of in-person communities, and so am I. And so I don't think it has to be an either-or situation at all. I think a lot of folks are going to get something from their in-person communities and are going to get a lot from digital communities, and there's no reason why we should have to choose or feel like one is a threat to the other. Ideally, they complement each other. And the other thing I was thinking about when you were asking your question was a very similar dynamic that happens to secular or cultural Jews, where you know, what I think was the question behind your question was, why is it so many people think digital Judaism is not serious? And that is frustrating, which is why you find yourself yelling in your house that, you know, digital Judaism is real. And that happens to secular and cultural Judaism all the time. People say we're not serious. So the folks I serve have this double stereotype or assumption people make about us that, like, you're secular Jews, you're cultural Jews, that's not serious Judaism, and you're doing it online, that's got to be bogus. And then, so I always feel like it's a kind of happy and somewhat rebellious thing I'm able to do with people when it's like, you know what, it is totally serious, it's totally meaningful, and if you only knew.
Can you help us understand more deeply the distinction between secular and humanistic? Because I know that in the history of the secular humanistic movement, there were two streams that combined together that do have differences. And when we spoke with Judith Seid, who comes much more from the secular stream, the emphasis seemed to be much more on Judaism as a cultural world of folks who came from the, you know, who essentially descended from Jews who used to be religious in the past. So could you give us a little bit more so that we can understand what folks in the world of secular humanistic Judaism mean when they say humanistic, for example?
So historically, the reason there are two streams of what could be something that's sort of similar is that secular Judaism, as it's sometimes known, as a movement, I mean, obviously there are lots of people who would call themselves secular Jews who have no idea of these movements or histories, but secular Judaism as a movement really came from the kind of secular Yiddishists that we think of as being, you know, foundational in creating North American Jewry from Ashkenaz in the, you know, early 20th century. And that was the origin of it. They were very anti-religion, very anti-hierarchy. They had no use for anything that would be called synagogue or rabbi, or, you know, like if you suggested they do some Torah study, they'd be like, why would we possibly want to do something like that? And yet they were deeply Jewish. They started the Forward. They educated their kids Jewishly. So there were things that were very important for them to retain in terms of Jewish identity, culture, and language, but they really were rejecting anything that seemed like religious Judaism or even a kind of structural Judaism, I would say. Humanistic Judaism, started by Rabbi Sherwin Wein about 50 years ago, and the movement itself is 50 years old this year, and it did sort of come from a more religious viewpoint. Not that the philosophy of humanistic Judaism is religious, but the structures are more familiar to those who come from a religious space. Sherwin Wein was ordained in the Reform movement. He was used to a synagogue space. He was used to something called services. He was used to celebrating all of the Jewish holidays, even if we were celebrating them in a different way. And so the humanistic Jewish movement is more like that, has rabbis, might do text study, might look in some ways more traditional, but the content of what we do tends to be rather untraditional. We create our own liturgy. So you have those two strands. And what I would say now is that those differences matter much less than our commonalities. I think what we're trying to do in any of those communities is create meaningful, beautiful Judaism for folks who are secular and cultural Jews. Whether you like to use the word humanistic or you don't, what you're doing is probably pretty similar. And what I'm worried about is some of this history can be a real turnoff to newcomers. Like, it's a little bit of a snoozer. But what counts now is much less that history, although history matters. I think it's useful to learn history for sure. But what are we actually doing in our spaces together? And if what we're doing is serving us and is making our lives better and is making us better forces for good in the world, then that counts much more than what we call our movement or what the history of our movement might be.
again, I come back to this phrase, you know, that when you said I practice Judaism every day, it feels to me like the quest is to find a Judaism that can be practiced every day by people who don't believe in some of the premises, right, that they've been taught to think are the ones that you're supposed to believe in, and nevertheless are able to find Judaism to be something so powerful, so valuable, that it would be worth practicing every day. And that feels to me like it doesn't come through in quite the right way when we talk just about secular, because sometimes, and again, not that people want it to be this, but that often I think that gets heard as, yeah, we don't do a bunch of things, as opposed to, I think, humanistic, but maybe other terminology that's really saying, no, this is about the things that we do, and that we are just saying that we're reinterpreting the source. Or, and I think that, by the way, I'm curious about whether you feel like doing secularsynagogue.com is giving you a new insight on some of that, because as Lex was saying, you know, what are the things that we can learn only through digital Judaism? You know, the ways that it's actually better than in-person forms.
Sometimes when people say secular Jew, they mean Jew by birth. But I don't care about being Jewish. I don't do anything Jewish. I'm pretty much not living my life Jewishly at all. To someone who's like, I'm a secular Jew and I see the world through a Jewish lens and I do Jewish stuff every day. So that's a pretty big range. Some of that dynamic comes from, I think, the internalization of exclusion. A lot of us folks who would go to spaces, whether they were synagogues or whether they were JCCs or youth groups or camp or whatever, and we were like, I'm Jewish, but I don't believe in God, or I'm Jewish and I don't believe in God, we were told, well, you're not a real Jew. Secular Judaism isn't real. So, you know, when you're dismissed like that, you do tend to disengage. And so it shouldn't be surprising that a lot of secular folks were like, there's no place in Judaism for someone like me. And so that's what we're up against. So I think that the movement of humanistic Judaism and the secular Jewish groups that are around have been very good for creating spaces for those folks who felt excluded elsewhere. But I don't want Judaism moving forward to be a reaction to exclusion. Frankly, I'm over it. Like, if you don't think I'm a real Jew, I don't care, you know? And I think a lot of people are with me that we're done with the judgment. And so secularsynagogue.com, I pitched, and I really believe this in my heart, it's a co-created community. And that's, I think, what people like about it. That when people say, hey, we should have a digital Seder, I'm like, amazing idea. I would have never thought that we should have a digital Seder, but of course we should. We'll work together on a Haggadah. We'll each make our own little Seder plate, and at home we'll dip the parsley together. That's so beautiful and enriching, and something that came out of the community, not coming from me. So what I think is exciting about the digital space and about a space that is unaffiliated, I will say, although I see myself as a rabbi affiliated with the humanistic Jewish movement, secularsynagogue.com is independent because I want it to feel really free and open as a space where people can bring their ideas, bring their energy, and create it. It is completely secular. We don't do any prayer, although as I mentioned, I will sometimes share traditional prayers for the sake of learning, or we'll look at Tanakh, which is Jewish Bible texts, together. But we're not reading those words with reverence. We're not praying. But it doesn't mean it has to look the way any previous community has done it. We get to figure it out together. One of my taglines when I created the community was meaningful Jewish community from the comfort of your couch. And what I said to folks was, what if it was possible to have a meaningful Jewish life in 5 to 10 minutes a day? What if we let go of the narrative that as a secular Jew, you know, if you don't speak Hebrew, if you don't keep kosher, if you don't attend services, if you're not part of a synagogue that meets in person, then you're not a real Jew. What if we say, actually, I'm doing more Jewish now in 5 minutes a day than I ever have before, and it's enriching my life and making me see the world in new ways, making me want to do good in the world because I understand Jewish imperatives around ethical behavior better. Like, that is a huge success story to me, if that's what we're able to achieve.
That is a huge success. I want to jump in a direction that may feel weird, and I hope it will make sense when I actually get to the question. I was surprised when I was learning about you in prep for this episode. You've got a PhD and you specialized in post-colonial theory and literature. And I want to talk about some, I want to talk about colonialism a little bit. And I want to talk about it with respect to what, to this language of secular and how we think about all these categories. Because my, and I've said this on the podcast in the past, we are working with language that was designed for a Christian context by Christians to define categories that make sense in the Christian world of believers, non-believers, because in that world, if you don't believe in Jesus as Messiah, as Son of God, that actually has huge ramifications for your salvation, etc. Like, we're talking about categories of secular Jews and religious Jews. And I think that even compared to 100 years ago, if I were to take aside my great-grandfather, who was out there on the soapbox as a socialist in New York, and would have identified, I'm positive, as a secularist, as a, all of these things, if he looked at me, he'd be like, you're awfully religious, dude. Like, you do a lot of religious things. You wear a yarmulke. You do, you like are interested in the Torah. You like, and similarly or inversely, if a religious Jew, somebody who thought of themselves as a religious Jew 100 years ago were to look at me, they'd be like, yo, man, you're very secular. You are not, you don't think of law in the Jewish context as binding. You pretty much look to Judaism as a set of things you can or cannot find meaning in. You think it's about building meaning and not like following God's words. Your conception of God is very different from most traditional conceptions of God. Like you're not. And so I think we're misusing language because the vast majority of Jews that are in anywhere in this context are really deeply secular, in quotes, and deeply religious, equally in quotes. And what's so interesting, I talked to friends of mine that are involved both as staff members and connected to Jewish Currents, the magazine, and they're navigating these questions like daily because there's these generational dynamics at play where people really want to identify like as an adjective, as secularist or as secular. And a lot of the young Jews that are really interested in the radical politics of Jewish Currents magazine, link in the show notes for those who don't know what that is, a lot of like they actually do see themselves as religious in some form or another today. And so I think all of these divides are dissolving. And I appreciate you saying that you're sort of winding the threads of humanist and secularist because I think it could be zoomed out even more. So you've got this post-colonial background and I didn't think I was going to ask about that. Does what I'm saying resonate in any way or am I off base? What's the deal?
I'm not that interested in these kinds of categorical questions. It is a marketing problem. When I'm like, how do I reach my people? What do I call them? How do they call themselves? I say all kinds of words. I say secular, humanistic, cultural Jew, spiritual but not religious, Jew-ish, or Jewish. Frankly, there are some people in secular
synagogue. You're saying you list them, right? Like you, I list, you say them all. Yeah, I just want to clarify.
You could be any, all, some combination. So what I'm trying to get across is that it's probable that not one term does feel right for you, and that's fine. There are folks who are religious, who would call themselves religious, who are part of secularsynagogue.com, and that's cool with me. It's not like I'm asking you to show your papers as a secularist when you enter the space, you know. So what I'm interested in is always like, what is meaningful? Let's cut to the chase. For me, what's meaningful for folks who are whatever we're going to call it, culturally Jewish is what I tend to say personally. I think what's meaningful is to stop defining ourselves in opposition to something, not say, I don't pray, I don't attend a traditional synagogue. Start saying what you do. Start saying what works for you, what is meaningful, what's valuable, and what does it look like in your life, just as we were talking about before. What holidays do you celebrate? How do you celebrate them? What rituals do you like? What words do you say? And that, I think, all might be hard to encapsulate in one term. I like the idea that it's a colonial imposition, the word secular. And I would offer that if that's how people see themselves, then I don't think that we have to reject it necessarily. It's fine. I think those terms within the Jewish world have often been used to determine who's in, who's out. Oh, you identify this way, then this isn't right for you. We're gatekeepers, we're territorial. And like that all has been so destructive in Judaism. I'm much more expansive in my thinking. I don't care what you call yourself. If you like what we're doing in the group, that's the right group for you. You know, and so I'll answer it that way. My post-colonial background, actually didn't have much to do with Judaism. I was on a different life path. It was a post-colonial literature project focusing on post-apartheid feminist literature from South Africa. And part of what I was talking about when I was talking about living your life in a Jewish way, I would say my Judaism informed my perspective in that dissertation, even though I don't think the word Jewish appears in that dissertation, because I'm interested in the experiences of exile, of insider-outsider, of the politics of language and culture. And so the dynamics of colonialism are very real and very powerful for all of us. In Canada, I would call myself a settler when I'm referring to our indigenous settler relations. But I also understand that as a Jew, we have our own histories of colonization and exile and diaspora. So it's super messy. I think it's wonderful to explore with a group of people who are interested in talking about it. And that's, to me, the work. Exploring those issues is much more interesting than how do we call ourselves when we're doing it.
Yeah. Shout out to Trafe Podcast, another Jewish podcast in the podcast landscape. Oh, actually, it's a Canadian Jewish podcast. So extremely relevant today. But they start every single one of their episodes by naming that they're settlers on Indigenous land in Canada. And I think that there's a lot for us as Americans to learn from, in general, how Canadians approach this issue in ways that I think are more thoughtful, more compassionate than in America sometimes we do. So I thought I'd name that. You got me thinking about geographic questions now that we're on this colonialism thread. And I wanted to ask sort of where are the people from that are part of secularsynagogue.com? I figure they could be from all around the world. And we've learned some interesting things about where our audience is lately. Where are your people located? And I mean, I guess maybe this is a stretch, but maybe not. Like, does that tie into some of these issues that we're talking about with colonialism, et cetera, whether it's in the digital space or more generally?
Members of secularsynagogue.com come from more all over than I would have thought. I was pitching it initially to a mainly North American audience, and I had expected a relatively urban audience because that's the Jewish community I tend to know, the Jews of Toronto and New York and Chicago, et cetera. But it's a lot of Jews from small towns, folks from Europe who, as secular Jews in particular, feel like they have no spaces. And so what we're able to do together is amazing across time and space and distance. So that has been wonderful. And just because we're talking about the politics of the colonial world, I have a really strong desire to see reconciliation and Indigenous rights and justice. That's a big issue for me across my professional life. I teach at a university that has a very strong Indigenous studies program, a First Peoples House of Learning. We have a teepee in our quad. I think it's really important as a Canadian, and I would say it's the same for those in the US, to take these issues seriously. My Toronto congregation has been working on several projects towards Indigenous reconciliation, and I tried to bring it to the secularsynagogue.com space. A lot of us are doing awesome work with pipeline protest support and Indigenous advocacy. But then I realized for the folks in Europe, it's a kind of a different landscape altogether. And so I just noticed that some of the ways I'm used to having these conversations shift as we take them to the digital world.
My last question about secularsynagogue.com is back to the name, back to the concept of a synagogue, because as you are describing a lot of what you're doing, I'm sitting here fantasizing like, yeah, that's what we should be doing. And we've been talking about all kinds of ideas that in one way or another are similar to what you're talking about. How can we create a real sense of community, a real sense of connection between the people who currently we call listeners, which is such a passive way to talk about people. And that's not really who they are and what they are doing. They're not just passively listening. They're very engaged, but they're kind of engaged in their own mind. How do we make that a communal experience? And in many ways, you're doing that from the other direction, sort of starting from the communal experience. But I would never call what we might build one day a synagogue, because in my mind, that just activates all of the services kind of notions that that I have in my mind. And yet you have those same notions in your mind, too, those same issues, you know, and you've decided to call it a synagogue. So I'm wondering if you could just reflect a little bit about what synagogue means to you in the context of what secularsynagogue.com is, which is probably not what most people think of as a synagogue.
It's definitely not what most people think of as a synagogue. And that's what I like about it. I see a kind of reclamation of the idea of synagogue as part of both the name and the community, the project of what we're doing all together. To me, what is a synagogue space? It is meant to be a place of gathering, a house of study. And we can do that online. We can do that together. We can do that as people who are culturally Jewish or secular Jews or however you term yourself. And so I saw it as really a kind of take back the synagogue phrasing. I also really think that one of the challenges when folks try to start stuff that's new is that we want to get so specific in what we call it that nobody knows what we're talking about. So if I called it like a digital space for cultural Jews who are getting together and doing Jewish stuff together, like what are you talking about? If you say synagogue, people kind of have a sense of what you're talking about. If you say secular synagogue, then they're like, huh, different from what I might expect. And if you say secularsynagogue.com, my hope is people will be like, okay, so I'm a cultural Jew who wants to do Jewish stuff online. This might be something interesting for me. It's not a perfect name. Some people have been like, synagogue, I would never join something called synagogue. But I think for a lot of us, we're willing to let some of that old definition go. And we're excited by the possibility of what can a synagogue be? It doesn't have to be what we grew up thinking it was.
One thing I was just thinking about is you, in describing how you're reaching people in Europe and in places all around the world, like you've encapsulated something that we talk a lot about when we're doing presentations about podcasting to people. Because the fascinating thing about the digital modality is, let's compare it to offline. So you're a synagogue in random mid-sized Jewish community in either Canada or the United States. If you're going to sustain yourself as an organization, even if you're going to be a small synagogue, you probably have to have one in every, I'm going to make up a number, but like, I don't know, one in every 50 Jews in your area that is one of your members or that cares about you, that is somehow connected if you're not a membership model. Like that's, it might not sound that much, but you have to reach a reasonably high percentage of people in your geographic locality to exist in any meaningful sense. The second that you are digital, you can reach one in every few thousand Jews on the planet, and you're reaching more than the average mid-sized synagogue. Like I think sometimes about how many downloads we've had, and it's like when you break it down, we're not reaching more than one in every many hundreds of American Jews. We could be sad about that. We could think, oh my gosh, that's nothing. Or we could say, wow, we're able to do a very specifically tailored conversation with a very specific lens that if we tried to do it in any local community, there'd be like three people. So that's a set of thoughts that I think that you've helped embody in what you're saying about secularsynagogue.com.
Not just that, but we had a snowstorm in Toronto the last time the Arenu congregation was supposed to get together, and we had to cancel. And so there's right. just logistics. There's all kinds of things that make it easier to reach more people if you're meeting where people are at. And where people are at is at home.
So this is a little bit of a gear shift, but it's going to be a great gear shift. Picture your very best ever shift in your car from one gear to the other. That's what's going to happen here. So segue, boom, here it is. You and I share something in common, which I'm really excited to talk about, which is that we are both intermarried or interfaith married, or choose the term. Interfaithless marriage has been a term some of our guests have talked about, including from the secular humanistic world. You are a rabbi and you are in an interfaith relationship. I am a rabbinical student. I am in an interfaith relationship. I would love to hear from you what impact that has on the work that you do, how that affects your lens, what any challenges that has led you to experience from members or prospective members or otherwise, and what we might be able to learn from a world where there would hopefully be more such leaders floating around.
Well, a couple of years ago, I had a piece in the Canadian Jewish News where I think it's called I Am an Intermarried Rabbi. And it was around a time where people were talking about intermarriage and whether rabbis should be allowed to be intermarried in other movements. I'll say in the secular humanistic Jewish world, there have always been intermarried leaders. It's not an issue. So I didn't have to get permission. I didn't have to come clean. There's nothing like that. And most of the people I serve in my congregation in Toronto and in secularsynagogue.com are in intermarriages or intercultural partnerships of some kind. So I'll say that a lot of what people expect to be a big deal isn't such a big deal. In that piece, I am an intermarried rabbi. I did talk about that question, what might happen? Because that's the question people have asked my whole life in the Jewish world. What will happen with intermarriage? What's the impact going to be on the Jewish community? And the phrasing of that question assumes the impact will be horrible. And so what I say is, what might happen if we have more intermarried leadership? We might model what it's like to live engaged Jewish life in the context of people who are intermarrying. And what might happen can be amazing, but that's up to us. In any of my communities, there's no barrier, whether or not you're the Jewish partner. And there are people in secularsynagogue.com who don't identify in any way as Jewish, but are partnered with folks who are Jews and want a community too. And sometimes the Jewish spouse isn't part of the community. Just the person who isn't Jewish wants to connect with this Jewish community. And I think that's beautiful and wonderful. So what I think I offer is some experience. I put out a guide that was about, you know, beyond the December dilemma, let's move to December delight and how we can do Chrismica in interesting ways. And I was able to share some stories from my own life. And not a lot of rabbis have been able to do that historically. And so I think that I can offer personal experience as well as a lot of professional experience. Most of the weddings I've officiated, most of the baby namings I've done have been for people who aren't all Jewish in their family. And so I know how you can make everybody feel seen and affirmed. I know how you can bring Jewish cultural content to a wedding or a baby naming and make it comfortable for everybody, regardless of Jewish identity or experience, and also affirm the cultures that are there that aren't Jewish. And one of the things I've really loved in secularsynagogue.com is the way we're talking about intermarriage. Not once has there been a negative word or one of those questions that are not real questions, like, well, how can you maintain a Jewish home for your children? None of that. It is assumed that you're part of this group, you're serious about engaging with Judaism in whatever way works for you, and we are not going to judge what that looks like.
I love that. And I want to be both an optimist and a cynic about that, because part of me thinks that, and this is why we need intermarried rabbis, part of me thinks that even if somebody did feel complicated feelings about intermarriage in one respect or another, is there any chance that you're going to communicate that in a space where the leader of it is intermarried? I think you got to have some chutzpah to do that. And so that's me being cynical. And I'm not saying anything about the members of your community having secret like objections. I don't have any reason to think that. But part of this is a practical consideration, which is that whoever's in the front of the room matters. Representation matters. And so I really just want to call out to people to like forget just accepting interfaith folks in your communities. Like, that's not enough. If you're not ready to be like them being the ones at the center of the room, them being the model of what, to use a terrible phrase, a good Jew is, if we're not ready to do that, including through having rabbis, the ultimate exemplar historically of who's sort of a Jewish leader, if we're not willing to do that, then no amount of welcoming or tolerance or acceptance or any of these words is going to ring true to those of us that are in interfaith relationships.
I couldn't agree more with everything you're saying. I would add that I think the partner who doesn't call themselves Jewish should also be able to be at the center of the room. I think that we have done a great disservice to our community and to the future of Judaism. This is the irony. Judaism, as I've grown up in it, has had two dominant narratives, and to me, they're completely in opposition to each other. One narrative is intermarriage is horrible. Well, they're, you know, this is going to be the end of Judaism. And the other narrative is about, like, not enough people want to connect Jewishly. How do we get people to our synagogue? Like, this is insane to me. They are completely in conflict. You want people to come, be inclusive, be affirming of who they are, and not in the, you know, BS way of like, we're welcoming of intermarried folks, but we have a lot of rules about how you can participate. And it's a little don't ask, don't tell. Like, actually inclusive, where these people are part of the fabric and, as you say, the leadership. I completely agree. If you can see it, you can be it. So I didn't grow up with a ton of models around intermarried leadership, but I did it anyway. And for my kids, there will be no question that if they, regardless of who they partner with, that they can do whatever they want in the Jewish world. If you said, you know, all these people said to me before I had kids, well, you know, the children of intermarriage, they get confused. Like, there's all this stuff we grew up hearing, right? And people still hear all the time. My kids are not confused. My kids are pretty clear on who they are. My daughter just got her report card from kindergarten this week. And in it, it talks about how she is so excited for Shabbat every week. There's no question that my children, who are the children of intermarriage, are meaningfully Jewish, and it's an important part of their identity. And so moving forward, I like to think that all these kids growing up now in spaces that are still not perfect, but are getting better, it won't even be a question they ask whether you can be intermarried and be meaningfully Jewish. They'll know you can because they'll know a bunch of people who are. And it won't be a question, could you be a rabbi or a cantor or a leader? They'll know that you can because they'll have examples. And that I do see as part of the work I can do as an intermarried rabbi. I want to pick up on the part about interfaith, interfaithless, intercultural. It is complicated. My intermarriage is probably less of an intermarriage than if I had married even a conservative Jew, let's say. My partner identifies as an atheist. I don't really identify as atheist, although I probably am one. To me, it's just not a central way I want to identify. I obviously identify as Jewish, and he doesn't. But the way we see the world and the way we live our lives, we're pretty in sync. There's no conflict between the way I want to do Shabbat and something that's comfortable to him, because we're not saying prayers that he doesn't believe in. And he likes ritual. He likes the way Judaism has informed his life in a cultural way that he didn't have before. He's glad our kids have it. We were together before I decided to become a rabbi. And he wasn't like, whoa, I didn't know I was going to be, you know, together with a rabbi. It was just like, sure, you should be a rabbi. You're so Jewish anyway. It was easy. I think a lot of the drama people imagine isn't there. I also think that one of the things having leadership can do is make space for more nuanced conversation. So because so many of us are in an environment that is anti-intermarriage, we always have to feel like we're defending intermarriage. And it's like, look, we are serious. Look, we are raising Jewish kids. Look, we are doing all this stuff. Whereas sometimes I want to be like, you know what? It is sometimes annoying to figure out whether we're going to have Christmas lights on my house. And I want a space where I can talk about that and not feel like I'm betraying the intermarrieds. You know what I mean? That's what I have in my communities, where we're able to have that level of nuance because we've let go of some of that anti stuff. And we're like, all right, there's intermarriage. How does it look? How does it work? What can we do to make your life good? I love the story of two members of the group, if I can just tell it quickly. One of them, so it's a Jewish person and somebody who isn't Jewish. And the person who isn't Jewish gifted a membership to secularsynagogue.com to her Jewish spouse because she was like, I think this will work for you. And that's really great. And then being part of the group, he was like, you know what? My partner would also get a lot out of this. And so he gifted a membership to her, but then she decided to join on her own. And there was this whole thing about like, oh no, my Christmas gift of the synagogue membership went awry. It was my favorite thing because I was like, of course the non-Jew gives it to the Jew, then the Jew wants to give it to the non-Jew as a Christmas present, even though it's a synagogue membership, but she decides to join on her own, seeing the value of it. Like, that is so beautiful to me that they both came to it for their own reasons, but both also are caring about what their partner will want and what will be interested in. That is intermarriage to me when it's working. You're engaged with your partner's life, but you don't have to be the same in all respects.
Thank you so much, Denise Handlarsky, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
It's been amazing. Thank you too.
And thanks as well to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. One more reminder, just like Dan said at the top, that we've got our awesome party. Yeah, our awesome party coming up on April 23rd digitally. There's a link at judaismunbound.com/party where there's more info. You can sign up there and we really hope that you'll join us. There's going to be a ton of our past guests there, some of your very favorites. And we hope that you'll join us and bring your party hats because it's going to be a good time. But our last request is that if you are able to, we always appreciate financial donations of any amount, whatever you're able to allocate. And you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate with either a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.